Again, Chazor Shuk for this semester's contemporary halacha. We're going to go through a bunch of shiurim. Let's start with the halachas of Tumas Kohanim, Rabbi Konigsberg's shiur. And one thing to keep in mind before we start this shiur is that there are three, throughout the context of the whole shiur, there are going to be three sekhsvekas that we're going to mention. So you'll see as we go. First of all, there's a gigantic machlokas, Tanoim, Amoraim, Rishonim, and Shulchan Aruch Mechaber, Rambam Mechaber, whether or not Tumas Ohel applies to an Akum. Meaning, can a Kohen enter a place where there's a dead body of a guy? So it's Machlokas, and Rambam says, sounds like Miyikr HaDin, whereas the Mechaber is Machmir, the Rambam sounds like he's Mekel, but he says you should try to be Makel. But Meikra Din, the Rama is Mekel. So we're going to work with that Rama for the rest of the Shir, that Meikra Din, he holds his mutter. There is a halacha called Tuma Bechibur, and that once you're touching Tuma, are you allowed to continue to touch more Tuma? Because anyway, you're not delaying your Tara, because you're going to have to wait 7 days, and today anyway is the first of the seven, or is the one before the 7 days. So that's Machlokas Rambam and Ravid. Ravid says that you're not being Mosifal Tumaso, so there's no Isser of Tuma B'chibur, and once you're ready touching Tuma, to touch more Tuma. So according to that, if we, the Dagomir Rav suggest that if you hold that Tuma B'chiburim is going to be okay nowadays, that Tuma B'chiburim is going to be okay, we could be Mitzaref, even though we don't really paskin like the Ravid on his own, that Tuma B'chiburim is okay, but if you're Mitzaref that, to the machlokas that we mentioned a moment ago, that the Rambam Meikra Din is Mekel by Meis Akum, so perhaps you could hold that there won't be Tumas Ohel by an Akum because of the Sekseka. Maybe the Halacha is like the Ravid, that if you're Tummy anyway, which all of our Kohanim nowadays are, there's no problem. And even if you are Machmir, that like the Rambam, that there's no Kula of Tumah B'chiburim Bizman Hazeh, you still could rely on the Rambam holds Meikra Din, there's no Tumas Ohel by an Akum, and therefore the Dagmar Vava would give that Svek Sveka to be Matir, an Ohel, Kohen being an Ohel of a Meis Akum, and therefore some suggested that maybe you could go to medical school as long as you avoid touching, but maybe being a Kohen being in a building where there's a Tumay Meis has that Svek Sveka to rely on. The problem is that we do not want to use, that we can't rely on this Ravid for a few reasons. First of all, he's not just the Machlokas, him and the Rambam, he's Mamash Adas Yachid. And even the Ravid himself, elsewhere, might have been chozer from what he holds, that there's a heter of Tumah B'chibur. And thirdly, even when he said that there's no problem being Mosif Tumah al Tumasa once you're Tameh, it might not have been a heter, it might have only been referring to a Ptur Malkos, but it would still be an Issa D'Araisa, even according to the Ravid, and certainly according to the Rama. So therefore, Ramosha paskins that cannot rely on this Ravid, and therefore it would be inappropriate to permit medical school based on this Ravid and the Svara of, for a Kohen at least, for the Svara of maybe Sakan Safashos, that's also Hevel Ushtus, says Ramosha, because first of all, yes, you have to save lives, but you don't have to go to medical school to save lives. Additionally, we have doctors who are non-Jews, and furthermore, we have doctors who are Jews, which is not a Kohanim. So if you're a Kohen, look for another job. Next point is the general question of if there's a mace on a floor, we assume that the ohel will carry the roof above the mace, will carry the tumah not just to that room, but all the rooms under that same roof, through the hallways, it's all one ohel. This brings us to a new question of sof tumah latzeis. Sof tumah latzeis says, even if there's a door that's closed, that theoretically should contain the tumah within the confines of those closed walls, if there is a door that we assume the mace will at some point on his way out towards to be buried, he's going to be going through those doors, so Halacha considers it, the Shulchan Aruch considers it, as though the mace is right there in that doorway right now. In which case, let's say there's an elevator that they plan, that theoretically the hospital will take a mace out through, you know, in 45 minutes from now, so the Kohen would not even be able to go to use that elevator even somewhere on a different floor, even if it's not in the context of Tumah right now, because that's going to be Sof Tumah Latzeis through that doorway. So here we come to our second Svek Sveka of the day. There, could we say the following Svek Sveka? The Shuas Yaakov writes that maybe this Chumrah of Sof Tumah Latzeis that we consider a mace to be at the doorway where he's going to be taken out later would only apply to a Jew mace, because there's a chiyuv to take him to bury him, but a guy, there's no mitzvah per se to bury a guy, so there's no it's not definitive that he's going to be taken out of any doors, so there won't be this isser of suggested Shuas Yaakov of Sof Tomalatzes for an Akum. Based on that, if Shatta says we could use a Sex Veka. If you hold that the whole ice concept of Sof Tomalatzes by an Akum is only a Chumrah, and also that which you hold the Tumasol Bechalal regarding an Akum, we, according to the Ramah, also hold as a Chumrah, so you don't have to be Machet, it's a Sex Veka, you don't have to be Machet with one Chumrah on top of another Chumrah, and therefore, Rav Shatta suggests that one could be Mekel by Sof Tomalatzes of a mace akum. Not everybody accepts that, but that's Rav Shechter's kula. Next point to keep in mind is, can a Kohen visit a mace in the hospital, friend, relative? So Rav Moshe Feinstein says that one could rely mi'ikr hadin, we follow Rove, that Rove goyim are Rov people in the hospital, of dead bodies will probably be nachrim, and mi'ikar hadin a nachri, according to the Ramah, is not makabel, is not mitami ba'ohel, and therefore, if it is a case of the tzorech gadol, you can be matir bikur cholim for a relative, or if it's a great tsar, if it's a father, a son who can visit, or alternatively for shalom bayis. So in those two cases, for a relative, close relative, a shalom bayis, then we'd permit being reliant on the ikur hadin, Rav Moshe says, that we could follow Rove, coupled with the fact that medina, a mace akum, is not the tami ba'ohel. Third point where we'll see a seksek is the following. Let's say there's a pregnant Ashes Kohen. We know that the dinim of Tumas Kohanim apply even to Ketanim, adult Kohanim are obligated to be Mazi, their children also on their Dine Kohuna. So can she go to Levi if she's pregnant with this baby? If he's a boy, then it could be a problem. If she's a girl, if the baby's a girl, fetus is a girl, then there's no problem. So the Shach cites Rokeach that it should be Mutter because of the Sex Veka. Safek if he's a Nefel or a Ben Kayama. And secondly, a Safek if the fetus is a Zachar or a Nekeva. Now, that's a Sex Veka that the Shach is making with. Now, the Magen Avraham asks a very simple question. Why do you have to come on to be Matir, this mother, this pregnant mother going to Beis HaKvaros based on Sex Veka? Typically, that's Tahara Blua, and the very fact that the fetus is enveloped inside the mother, that would not be, she would not be able to contract Tumah, just like if you have a ring that you'd swallowed, you'd walk into a cemetery, the ring does not become Tumah Blua. So Reb Chaim Ozer answers in Achiezer with a very big Yisod that we're going to talk about a few applications of this Yisod, and that is that when we talk about a Kohen becoming Tameh, the Isser for a Kohen is not to become Tameh in the halachic definition of Tumah V'Tahara, but rather the Isser is an Isser Kiruv L'meis. So even if we say technically the fetus is Balua and it will be Tahara Blua and there won't be, the baby won't become Tameh technically, nevertheless, the fact that the fetus would be in an Ohel Lameis and in a cemetery and a Karav Lameis, that's why it's going to be Asur, and that's why he had to come on to the Sex Sveka to be Matir. Now, obviously, let's just finish this point before we see other applications of this concept of Isur Kiruv Lameis. Once we're talking about this Sex Sveka, that only is going to work if you have a Sex Sveka. If it's the ninth month, there's no longer a Suffolk Nefel. Or if it's there's an ultrasound and there's no longer a Safek Nekeva, Safek Zachar, Safek Nekeva, so you knocked off one of the Sveikas and you will not be able to rely on the Sex Sveika. So if, for example, there's a Hakamas Matseva, then a mother, a pregnant woman, should find out if it's a boy or a girl. If it's a boy, she should not attend. If it's a girl, then she'll have her Sex Sveika, unless it's the ninth month. Now, this concept that the Achiezer set down, that whenever there is, that this Isra of a Kohen is not to be Mitami, but to come close to a mace, could explain the following. The halacha is, cherev harehu kecholol, if there is ever a piece of metal that touched, or scalpel, that touched a mace, that stays like a viavos hatumah. And Tosis asked that every house has, you know, some piece of metal that was, I don't know, touched the maze. I don't know why that's so obvious. But every house has a piece of metal that touched the maze. Why is it permitted for people to be in that house with that piece of metal from a, you know, if there's a grandfather had a watch that he was wearing when he died, so that watch is in the house, the whole house should become tame from that. So according to Achiezer, we can understand, because even if halakhically there is tuma in the house from that chayv ha'reu kachal, that metal watch that was on the wrist of a corpse, nevertheless, you're not coming close to, the kohen is not coming close to a mace. The mace is gone years ago and miles away, and there's no iser karav lemace, krav lemace, because he's not karav. We'll see a third application of that concept of Achiezer in a few minutes. In terms of driving over a road that's plowed right over a cemetery, so would the car be chotzis b'fnei atoma and allow the passengers to therefore drive there? So the question is, would a car be considered an ohel zarek? If it's an ohel zarek, then it's not an ohel zarek lav shmei ohel, and therefore it will not be able to be chotzis, and there will be tuma. If it's an ohel b'fnei atzmo, so then it won't contract tuma. So even if you assume that an ohel zarek is an ohel, and therefore maybe it's not all Zarek, it is an Ohel, then it theoretically should be able to be Chotzis. The problem is that the car is metal, and therefore it might Viter not be able to be Chotzis with Neha Tuma. So there's a question of the status of all Zarek for a car. Next point in the Shir is, what about going under tree overhangs? And here you sort of have to look at where the tree is situated, as far as where the road is situated, and how far the trees from the kever, as follows. The Shulchan Aruch says that you can't go, if there's a tree coming out of the graveyard over the road, and you don't know if the branch of the tree that's going over your head on the road where you're driving or walking is going over the kever or not, it's going to be usur. But if you know for certain, just the way the branches are situated, that when you're driving on the road, you're not going to be under that same branch that is also hanging over the kever, it will be mutter to drive on that road, especially since that branch, if it's not wide enough of a tefach width, it will not be able to be maybe tum at all. However, of course, if the branch comes out, grows in the basic varos, goes over a kever and then extends from that kever onto the street, so that will be on your head and the kever's head, then it will be oh my heel, and you'll have a problem going under that branch. Let's talk about an airplane now, an airplane flying over the cemetery. So here we have a question of, will the plane, which is made out of aluminum, be considered, be able to, is it mekabel tuma because it's metal, or no, maybe it's not the metal of the Torah. So the Torah only lists six metals. Are they just examples? Are they an exhaustive list? The Gra is mekel and holds that only the six metals of the Torah are metal, and therefore anything else is not, according to the Torah's definition, considered a metal, and therefore it would, will not contract tumah, it will be chotzis b'fnei tumah. Others are machmir and say, no, all elements that have metal metallic properties, I don't know if in chemistry, I think they said ductile and malleable are the properties of metals, so those will all have a din of metal, and therefore it will be, you will be in a davar hamekabel tumah on top of a, you know, 5,000 feet above a mace, and that will be a problem. But if we go back to this point of the Achiezer that Shechter likes to use, that the isra of a kohen coming to a mace is not contact, not becoming tumah per se, which it is, would become tumah in a plane, but rather an isra of krevel a mace. Here, if you're 5,000 feet away from the mace, there's no, even though there might be tumah, yes, and the kohen would theoretically become tumah. But the iser of being nizhar l'tumah is only to come close to tumah, to not come close to tumah. And here, 5,000 feet away is not close to tumah, and therefore it might be permitted, according to this lamdus of the Achiezer, for a kohen to fly over a mace, even in a metal airplane. To finish off this shir, what about a dead Jewish body in the cargo of the plane? So the best thing you could do is make a plastic box, so the box will be chotzis b'fnei atoma. The problem is that if you want the box to contain and confine the tumah within, it has to be an ohel. Do we consider this an ohel zarek? Literally, it's flying through the air, right? So on one hand, you could say the Chalukas Yaakov says, no, we're not going to consider this box to be, this coffin to be an ohel zarek. because relative to the passengers in the plane, it's not moving. He's in his seat, the car, things in the cargo, and relative to one another, they're not. One is not moving. Therefore, it would not be considered a zarek. It would be an ohel, and the plastic box would contain the tuma within it. Others reject this svara because why does the fact whether the kohen is sitting in his seat or moving around or flying through the air, why does that change whether or not the box in the cargo is considered an ohel zarek or not? Why should that change the status of the coffin? Perhaps another svara says that even if the box is chotis b'fnei atoma, there could still be a problem because the box is sitting on the plane and the plane itself is mekabel toma, so it's like the plane is a mamid for the coffin. Even if the coffin is not mekabel toma, but the box, the mamid was holding up the, if you don't have a plane holding up that corpse, it's going to be plummeting 5,000 feet in the air and splashing in the Atlantic Ocean. So therefore, there's a question in terms of kohanim going on planes. Try to avoid it. That's the end of the first shiur regarding tumah. Now let's talk. What?
Try to avoid it? Kohanim should fly, never?
Kohanim should try to fly, not on planes that are carrying mason. Yeah, thank you. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech haolam, shehakol nehyeh bidvarav. So the first point in the shiur on Hilchos Mezuzah is that a mezuzah, the Torah says, is al mezuzas beisacha. So the question is, what is a bias? So in general, the Gemara tells us that any room that's dalet al dalet, which in Moshe Paskins is 7 foot 3 inches by 7 foot 3 inches, that's a bias, that's chayav in a mezuzah. The question that we have to ask, is it only 4 by 4, or is it as long as you have 16 square amos? In other words, is 8 by 2 also a bias? So the Rambam says 8 by 2 is chayav in mezuzah. The way they understand the Rosh is, no, you need a minimum of 4 amos on each side, on each edge of the house. The Shach Paskins, that if you don't have 4x4, will be machmir for the rush, and we will not say a bracha, even if we might put on a mezuzah. The Taz, on the other hand, says that, really, if you have something that's 8x2, that's not a livable area. Therefore, nobody, the way he understands is nobody really holds that it's chayiv. Even the Rambam holds that it's not chayiv. And he has some other explanation of the Rambam, and therefore the Chazanish is make like the Taz, and therefore, according to that Taz, as passing by the Chazanish, if you have a narrow hallway that's less than, let's say, 7 feet or so, it will never need a mezuzah. Now, when we talk about the size of rooms, until now, we're just talking about size, but there is something to consider in terms of the use of the room. Here, there's a Chamudei Daniel, who says that this shear of Dalet al Dalet is only significant for a normal base dira, which needs 4x4. But sometimes you have the kind of room that the way you live there, use that room, the guard booth across the hall is across the street, that's a usable guard booth, even though it's not Dalet al Dalet. So too, you have that's a base sha'ar, you might have a merpeset, you might have some other kind of room that is usable, even less than 4x4. So therefore, if it's chazi lemilsei, even in the smaller shear, that would be chayav in a mezuzah, even less than dalet al dalet. So therefore, if you have an anteroom, like many of us have in the Heights, right before that opens up into your living room, the anteroom is less than dalet al dalet, but it's serving its purpose of being an anteroom. That's what it's called, an anteroom. And will therefore be chayav in a mezuzah. Now, that would not apply to a regular closet, but a walk-in closet, the same story would apply. If a walk-in closet is a room that the tachlis of this room is to use as part of your house as a walk-in closet, even though it's less than dal al dal, it would be chayav. Do we pass like this chumra of the Chamudei Daniel? So apparently, Rav Aaron Feldman's son, on Hilchos Mezuzah, writes that when it comes to anterooms and hallways, we do put up a mezuzah, and even if it's less than dal al dal, but when it comes to closets, we don't put mezuzahs on closets, even if they're walk-in, so long as they're not dalet al dalet. Now, while we're talking about closets and uses of rooms, there's a Rebbe Kaveh Eger that's understood in different ways, but one way to understand Rebbe Kaveh Eger is he says that even though if you're going from the room into the closet is small, but if you would be walking from that closet into the room, you're going into a room that has dalet al dalet, and therefore you would need a mezuzah on the right side from going from the closet into the room. Now, Rabbi Simon doesn't like that because that's against the whole concept of biaskad. There's something called the derech bia as opposed to something called the derech yitzia. here this Rabbi Kveger is saying that whenever you go one way, even if you're going one way, and it doesn't need a mezuzah because you're going into something very small, but when you go in the opposite direction, out of the closet, into the room, then you should need, and that's just against the concept of derech b'yoscha. Fine, that's Rabbi Kveger. Now, in general, it's important to know that we never put a mezuzah on both sides of the door, but that won't be baltosif, because one's right, one is wrong. But if you put two mezuzahs on one doorpost, then it would be an iser of baltosif. Now, both the Chamudi Daniel and Rabbi Kveger are both chumras. Rabbi Simon prefers if you had to be machmer for one, he'd be machmer more machmer for the Chamudi Daniel rather than the Rabbi Kveger. The sheet of the Rambam is that if there's no delis, like many of our living rooms and dining rooms, there are doorways, there might be tzuras ha-pesachs, but there's no actual door, and therefore it does not need a mezuzah. We are make a like the Rambam, so we don't make a bracha, but we're machmir to, yes, put a mezuzah there anyway, but we just don't make a bracha to be, for the shitas Rambam. Now, in terms of the positioning of the mezuzah on the door, the halacha is it has to be on the shlisha elyon. If you put it on the wrong side, if you put it below the shlisha elyon, or too high up within the taf tefach, you're not even yotzei mitzvah mezuzah whatsoever. And this is true even if for a kid's room, it still has to be at the shlisha elyon, even if a kid can't reach it. Ideally on the bottom of the shlisha elyon. However, what happens if it's a very tall door? Yerushalmi, cited in the shach, says that you should place it at the shoulder height, even if it's going to be below the shlisha elyon. But wait a second. Why? I thought shlisha elyon is shlisha elyon. So the Chazon Ish says that no. There's no stira between this Yerushalmi that says you should place it at shoulder height, even below the shlisha elyon, and that which we assume that it has to be at shlisha elyon from our Gemara, from the Bavli. Because the real halach is that it has to be at shoulder height. So shoulder height is usually shlisha elyon, and in the case of a very tall door that the Yerushalmi was speaking of, that will end up being at your shoulder height, even though it's below the shlisha elyon. So then really, there's no machlokas, Bavli and Yerushalmi. Point is, put it at the shoulder height. This question would apply to some kitchens in Washington Heights where there's a doorway, but on the right and left there are cabinets, and then there's a countertop, and then pushed further out from the walker, the person walking in, are the walls going up to the ceiling. So do you put on the shlisha elyon of the actual doorway or of the cabinet that's only about till your waist? So we're asked, the Nesivos says that if the cabinet would be 10 tefachim high, you'd put it on the cabinet. However, according to what we said, that the shlisha elyon is a function of shoulder height, so you wouldn't put it on the cabinet. That's not shoulder height. Even though it is shlisha elyon, you'd put it higher on the doorway, the doorpost. In terms of positioning, when you put it wherever you put it height-wise, in terms of width-wise, where should you put it? You should put it as outside of the doorpost as you can to maximize the shmira, that there'll be more shmira, more area will be shomer. In terms of leaving mezuzahs there, there's machlokas, whether the point is that you don't want to take shmir away from the person coming in after you. So the Ramah says that you should leave it there and charge him for the money that you paid to buy these mezuzahs. But if he doesn't want to pay you, says the Ramah, you could just go ahead and take them with you. The Aruch HaShulchan is machmir and says, no, you could ask him for the money, but if he doesn't pay, you have to leave them there. Rabbi Abadi, the Rabbi Simon quoted, says, if you're not sure who's going to move in at all, and they don't know who to collect from, then you could, again, take it with you. In terms of what kinds of living places do or do not require mezuzah, Allah, the Shulchan Aruch, writes that a storage area, Beis HaOtzar, is chayav. Reach Kamenetsky points out that's only if it's storage as part of your dira, but if it's a self-storage room, somewhere in, Manhattan self-storage and the like, that's not associated with dira, and storage itself wouldn't. Shuls are potter from mezuzah. Beis Medrash is a machlokas, whether it's basically, on one hand, the Talmidim learn there all day, so it's like a dira. Others say, no, it's not a dira. Lamai says, it's nachum lahachmir, but we do not say a bracha when we post a mezuzah in the Beis Medrash. To finish off this shir, an office building. The Shulchan Aruch says that a chanus is potter, because it's diras arai. But it could be that that's only if it's like a makeshift store in the market, something more permanent, there it would, it is somewhat, it is not so arayah, it's a little more kevan, therefore it would be proper to have a mezuzah. So we do it, we do put one up without a bracha. If there's a question that a person has a, you know, in terms of their, you know, their clients are going to look funny, you know, if they have this thing on the wall, it might cause problems with the business, so mikra, then they don't have to put one up. That's the end of the next year. It is Halatz of Chol HaMoed, Rabbi Adler. So Mishnah Pirkei Avos says, "Hamavaze es Hamoados ein lo chelak l'olam haba." Question is, what is Moados? So the Rishonim say it's talking about Chol HaMoed, because it says Mavaze, not Mechalal. If it would be Mechalal, it would refer to Yontif. But Mavaze means there's no chil involved, so it must be Chol HaMoed, and Mavaze would mean to not treat Chol HaMoed properly. Ba'achila, ushsia, and others say ilavush, so it doesn't have to be as nice clothing as Yontif or Shabbos, but it does have to be nicer than weekday. The main question here is the Isser Malacha on Chol HaMoed, an Isser Daraisa, or an Isser Darabanan. The Gemara in Chagiga cites five drashos for an Isser Malacha as follows. Meforesh HaPasuk, Chag HaMatzos Tishmar Shivas Yamim. So you have to keep it for 7 days. Obviously, that's including Chol HaMoed. That's by Pesach. Similarly, by Sukkos, Kol Melechas Avodah Lo Sa'asu Shivas Yamim. Same point, 7 days for Sukkos. There's another Amora who says, it's a Kal Vachomer, it's actually a funny Kal Vachomer. If the beginning is Asur, and the end is Asur, Kal Vachomer, the middle days are Asur. It's more complicated, but this is the quick way to remember it. Rabbi Kiva, fourth Amora, says that there's just actually three words in the Torah. Elam Moadei Hashem is miyuter. Since it's miyuter, that's going to teach you the Issa Malach of Chol HaMoed. And then there's a fifth Amora who says something a little bit more complicated, so we'll omit it. Now, even though these, the passage of the Gemara sounds like there are five psukim, and some of these seem pretty strong, Tosus says that they're only asmachtas, and he proves that the Issa Malach must only be drabana with the following three questions. First of all, we know from the Mishnah Megillah that there are four aliyahs on Chol HaMoed, not five, like Yontif, and it relates to the Issa Malacha. So therefore you see that it's a lower level than Yontif, so obviously it's not Doraisa. Secondly, how could there be kulas within the laws of Chol HaMoed of something like Dover HaAved, Tzarech Rabim, and the like? If it's Doraisa, you don't have such exclusions. Thirdly, as Tosfos, we know from the Yerushalmi, has a lashon, Klum Asru Malacha El Lachal Velulmo Torah. That word Asru is mashma that it's Asu Derabanan. Ella says Tosus, the whole Issur Malach, these are all Asmachtas, it's only an Issur Derabanan. And the nature of the Derabanan is that Chazal wanted to pick certain parameters that will maintain these days as days of Lachal Velulmo Torah. As far as other Rishonim, whereas Tosfos just holds Derabanan, Sefer Chinuch holds its Doraisa. If you hold its Doraisa, then how are you going to have these unusual parameters that Tosfos pointed out until the Tzarech Davar HaAved and Tzarech Rabim? So there, the Sefer Chinuch says explicitly that although the Isser is an Isser Doraisa, but Masra HaKos L'Chachamim, it's actually the Gemara says this, Lashem Masra HaKos L'Chachamim, to determine what are the parameters of that Isser Doraisa. Now, obviously, there are nafkaminas whether you hold that Isser Malach is midoraisa drabanan, and these are really nothing to do with Chol HaMoed. Whenever you have a shayla, if something's doraisa drabanan, you will apply shvus to shvus for Malka Mitzvah. Meaning, could you tell a guy to do a malacha on Chol HaMoed for Malka Mitzvah? Would that already be the shvus to shvus? Secondly, if there's a chiv tefillin, might also be told if there's an Isser Malach doraisa. Thirdly, whether you have a suffik malacha, as we'll point out some suffik malachas a little bit later, will that be, if there's machlokas, could you be mekel there? Now, in terms of the halachas of what malacha is permitted, four general categories. First of all, davar ha'aved, we'll talk about them in a moment. Secondly, tzarech ha'moed. Thirdly, po'al she'en l'mayochal. Fourthly, tzarech rabim. I will point out, going back to the second one, tzarech moed, there's a distinction of what kind of tzarech moed. If it's tzarech moed for ochel nefesh, then it is completely mutter, even a ma'isa uman. On the other hand, if it's a regular tzorech hamoi, but it's not for alchon nefesh, then we would only permit a ma'isa hediot. Those are the general categories. Now let's talk about a fifth point, which is not in terms of the malacha, but the question is tircha per se, just being toreach, when there's no malacha, is that going to be an iser chalamoid? And once we ask that question, we could also ask the inverse question. If you have a malacha that's not a tircha at all, just like flicking on a light, making a phone call, where there is a malacha, but it's not a tircha, so would that be aser if it's not for tzorech hayom? This point is going to be a machlokas, so stira and tosos, machlokas rishonim. An application would be, if there's no malacha, but there would theoretically be tircha, if you want to put away, it was actually a halacha ma'is in my family this year, if you want to put away the dishes on the last day of Chol HaMoed, because you're going away for the last days, so there's no malacha at all in putting dishes in a box and carrying a box to the basement, but that would still be, perhaps, an issur of tircha. Shulchan Aruch says that you're not allowed to move from a house to house because of tircha. Next point. In general, the whole issur of muktzah and the gzeros that we have of Shabbos Yontif do not apply on Chol HaMoed. Now let's get into those four exceptions, and let's get into some details about them. So first of all, let's talk about Tzorech HaMoed first. We mentioned that Tzorech HaMoed has a split personality. If it's for Ochel Nefesh, then it's mutter to do even a Ma'aseh Uman. So if you're a professional pastry chef, you could make and bake as something as pretty and as beautifully designed as you like. Other Tzorechei Moed only heter, only mutter for Ma'aseh Uman, or Ma'aseh Hediot. And even when you do that Ma'aseh Hediot, there are still two more criteria that are subsections of this heter of Ma'aseh Hediot for Tzorech HaMoed. A, that it has to be Bitzina, because not everybody's going to realize that it is a Tzorech HaMoed, unless it's obvious, like selling fruits and vegetables. Everybody realizes that for the last days you need new fruits and vegetables, so then it would not have to be Bitzina. Additionally, even if it is a Tzorech HaMoed, it would have to, you cannot be Mechavin Malachto and purposely schedule it to take place on Yontif for your convenience. As far as the geder of what's a ma'aseh uman that would be prohibited for a tzorech hamoed, let's talk about, for example, cars. If you change your flat, that's a ma'aseh hedid. You could change a flat if you want to go to the to great adventures for Chol HaMoed. If you want to change your transmission, that's definitely ma'aseh uman, and that would, even though you're not going to be able to go to great adventures because the car is broken, the transmission is broken. Do we still have transmissions?
Yeah, it's not transmissions.
That would be an isser, even if you do want your car for going on the trip. Now, then we get into a very important shaila, and you'll see why it's important in a moment. The shaila was asked by Polaroid cameras, but you'll see where it's very nogei l'maisa. For me, I have a shaila every year. Do we define maisa uman that's usser based on the skill that was invested into doing it, or just how the finished product looks? Now, if you come in a Polaroid camera, so all you did was press a button like a dodo head, but what came out was a beautiful picture. So this was actually a machlok, because the Igros Moshe says, since anyone could do it, it's not a ma'isa uman, mutter, v'tzorech yontif. However, Yaakov Kamenetsky said, since it has a professional touch, it's a ma'isa uman. Now, nowadays we don't use so many Polaroids, but we do. When I, if I'm giving shiurim on the last days, I always want to print out my shiurim on Chol HaMoed. Could you use a printer? So here, this is going to be the same question. If anyone could do it, anybody could just send something to print, and that's not a Uman. On the other hand, the print, the cover, the finished product, you have a beautifully typeset with highlighting here and other things, so that would look like a Maisum, that could be a problem. So therefore, Halakha Maisa, it's probably better to avoid printing if a person can, even if it's the Tzorech, even if it's the Tzorech Moed. Yeah. You put it on draft instead of high resolution. Good question. Something to think about. I'm not sure. Let's go to one more point. Within Tzorech HaMoed, we said that for Tzorech HaMoed, you're not allowed to do it if it's a Ma'aseh Uman. There is an exception. the main exception we mentioned was ochel nefesh, but can we apply ochel nefesh only to foods, or does it extend even to what we call tzarechei haguf? So here there's a Mishnah in Moed Katan, that a woman is allowed to do her makeup even like an uman. And the Rishonim explained, because anything that's kishat haguf is a tzarech haguf, it's just like ochel nefesh, and we will permit mais uman for all tzarechei haguf. Based on that, we could extend it even further. Let's say something broke in your house. Well, if you just want to fix it, that's a mais uman, that would be aser. But if it's something that's like a toilet that you need for yantif, or if it's a lock that's going to prevent you from using part of your house, getting into your house, and you need to call an uman, that would be permitted, or maybe security, that would be permitted even to have an uman do work on Chol HaMoed, because that's considered tzarech haguf, as an extension of, which is an extension of Ochel Nefesh, and that would be permitted even the tzarech uman. To head towards the finish line of this year, in terms of appointments, there are different kinds of appointments. So Moshe says explicitly that a routine checkup is usher at the dentist. Of course, if a person has pain or a cavity or it's going to get worse, then of course it's mutter, would at least be davar ha'aved, at least, if not more. However, there are those that are tzitzoldik or poskim say that for dental and doctor visits, it is okay to go on Chol HaMoed, even for routine checkups, because the Shulchan Aruch says elsewhere that taking medicine, doing anything l'refuah, is mutter Chol HaMoed, so since you're going for refuah purposes, this would not be a problem of tzarech hamoed. That it's not considered tzarech hamoed because it's routine, but nevertheless it's everything medicinal or health related, some posts can say, would be okay. In terms of the parameters of davar ha'aved is the next point. In terms of the parameters of davar ha'aved, there are limitations. Even if something's a davar ha'aved, it has to be a hefsid, not a minyas revach. Secondly, it cannot be an excessive tircha. And thirdly, even if there is a davar ha'aved that you have to do, you can't say, oh, I'm busy now, I'm off for a few days on Yom Tov, I'll take care of it during Chol HaMoed. That would be mechavi melachta l'moed, which it would be aser even for davar ha'aved. Once davar ha'aved is permitted, didn't meet those limitations, then we'd permit it even for mayis uman. So if, let's say, there's a drip that happened on Yontif in your house and it's flooding the part of the basement, even if it's not a part of the basement that you're going to use or the kids need to play, it's not a tzarech haguf, but you'd have to call a professional plumber or a contractor, thank you, then it would be mutter because of davar ha'aved. As far as pragmatia, the Gemara says pragmatia is aser. And the reason is, even though there's no malacha per se, it's only in Issa Drabban at most, nevertheless, the whole point of Chol HaMoed is lechol v'lomo Torah, and if you allow pragmatia, which is undermine the whole focus of the day, and even when there will be a heter of tzarech ha'moed to permit some commerce, it should be done b'tzina, like for example, with some kind of shinui. You'll see this in Borough Park, like by the jewelers or the clothing stores, they'll have the shutters half down. So you can really get in, but it looks a little bit different. Very cute thing. It's a great thing to say over on Yontif. Tzarchei Rabim, why are Tzarchei Rabim mutter on... First of all, what kind of Tzarchei Rabim are permitted when we say that it's mutter on Chol HaMoed? It's only Tzarchei Rabim that relate to things of Tzarchei Haguf. So for example, if you want to fix a toilet in the shul, if you want to make it that somebody's not going to trip or hurt themselves in the shul, that's permitted. But just to build a new wing for the shul, or they want to build a new, they're building in the middle of building up a new base medrash, and they want to do work on Yantar, that is not considered Tzarchei Rabim, that it is permitted. Now, why do we nevertheless permit these Tzarchei Rabims that relate to Tzarchei Haguf on Chol HaMoed? There's a fabulous Ravid that, again, I urge you to file away in your minds and use it whenever you're involved in a community, is because the Ravid says that you have to do these on Chol HaMoed, because if something's a public issue, by definition, no one feels the responsibility to ever do it. It will never happen. However, if people are off anyway from Chol HaMoed, so then they have time to take care of all the things that they wouldn't be able to, that would otherwise never get done, and therefore, the best time is when people are off. Yeah?
Was there any regular
This is, I'm not sure, but I think that this would be, even Tzarchei HaGuf, when we said you're allowed to do Maisa Uman, is, for example, it's the only toilet in the house. But if it would be a fourth toilet in the house, so don't use that fourth bathroom. You're not allowed to do Maisa Uman for your Tzarchei HaGuf, for your personal Tzarchei HaGuf. However, if it would be in the shul, anything that relates to Tzarchei HaGuf, like there's a problem with the mikvah, so anything in the mikvah, not that, oh, we're not going to have the tefillah on the third night of Chol HaMoed if we don't have a Pav Lamer come tonight. No. Anything that relates to the mikvah, you can take care of on Chol HaMoed, because that's Tzarchei, so Tzarchei HaGuf, Dika, Tzarchei Rabim. Anything that relates to the toilets, you could do for shuls, for Tzarchei Rabim. As opposed to, you know, building new wing for a base medrash for the early Hashkama minion, that would not be the kind of Tzarchei Rabim that would be permitted. Okay, that's the end of that shir. Now let me ask you, do you want to talk about ribis, or do you want to talk about Hilchos Tzedakah?
Ribis.
Okay, let's talk about ribis. First point we have to realize is that ribis is not Chosh HaMishpat, but Yoredeya. The way the Tur explains it is the point of ribis is that it's not a function of mechila. What does that mean? If it's not a function of mechila, that means it's nothing to do with somebody willing or not willing. It's an iser, even if the owner is not makpid, even if the person who pays the ribis is not makpid. My son made a deal with a friend of his, and one of my sons, they're all young, so it doesn't matter which one. One of the very young sons made a deal with his friend in Breuer's. He'd give him candies, and the other fellow owes him 75 cents. And for every day late that he pays in 75 cents, he'll have to pay an extra nickel. So, whatever. About 2 weeks later, he paid up $1.60. And what made me feel good is the fact that the other kid involved was the son of a Rosh Yeshiva. So, Baruch Hashem, at least to keeping, you know. My son charged service only for Chashuvim. Okay, so that's the point. Even if you want, everybody's happy to take out a loan. When I go for a loan to take out a mortgage, I want to pay ribis, but I'm still not allowed to. When the Torah says ribis or neshach, it's the same, even though they're two pesukim of the Torah, it means the same exact thing. The Torah says lanachri tashach machlokas, whether it's a mitzvah to lend ribis or there's no mitzvah. So the rabbi says maybe it's not, you really shouldn't do it because you might end up doing it to a yid. But either way, halacha maisa, we are permitted to lend with ribis to and from a guy. What about using them as middlemen to sort of convert every loan from me to you? Just put it through a guy, a middleman. That's where the Torah says, as it says other places, wherever there's something that you could sort of hide from anyone knowing, it will still be aser. Two kinds of ribis, I mean, a lot of kinds of ribis. The ribis d'oraisa is only if it is money, and it is specified beforehand, like my son's case. Well, my son's case, no, because that was not, I'm lending you money, it was part of a sale, so it would only be d'rabbanan, but there would have to be a specified return, either a rate or a daily penalty for the delay, for the delay of repayment. That's called ketsutza. The halachas of ketsutza, there are three nats gezunt. There are going to be a few nafkaminas whether something is deraisa, as we just described, or it would only be one of the numerous kinds of ribis derabanan. First nafkamina is whether it's yotzei b'dayanim, only ribis deraisa is yotzei b'dayanim. Secondly, only by ribis deraisa is there an iser on all the ancillary participants, like the edim, the sofer, otherwise known as a lawyer, anybody else who's involved with making the loan happen. That's only going to be an usher for those people if it's an iser d'oraisa. So if you're involved, if you're a lawyer and you're drawing up a contract for an iser for ribis d'rabanan, you don't have to be worried if you're only the lawyer. Thirdly, there is a heter for ribis d'rabanan to invest it for yisomim, meaning that yisomim can take ribis on if it's ribis d'rabanan. So some people extend, the post can extend it, yisomim to all stock of money, maybe yeshivas, and therefore yeshivas can charge ribis d'rabanan, which might be very important for if you assume that if you took out a scholarship from YU and then after you graduate you have to pay back loan with interest, you're assuming that YU is hesitant staka, and therefore they could charge rivis. We'll see why it will be the Rabbanan in a few minutes. Or maybe right now. One thing that makes ribis drabanan is if it's milva b'shtar. In other words, I'm not giving you a dollar and you'll give me a dollar 10 next week. Rather, I'm going to give you a shtar that will enable you to collect something. So for example, if I have a $1,000 bond due in 10 years, so I need cash now. So you know what I'm going to do? This is not good for 10 years. It doesn't help me right now. I need cash now. So I'll swap this with you for a $7,000 bond due this year. So I end up giving you $3,000 because you're giving it to me access to the money 3 years earlier. So that's going to be ribis b'shtaros. That's only drabanan. Where do you find ribis and shtaros? Well, every time you write a check, you're writing that this person, it's an IOU. You have the ability to collect this amount from my bank account. Good luck. Hatzlacha. That would also, presumably, if you assume that checks are shtaros, which is many poskim do hold, that would make it only an issur d'rabbanan, which means that most business transactions which do take place with checks will only be an issur d'rabbanan, and therefore, if you're a lawyer, you could write the contract for that transaction. Whenever you have late fees, for example, are a great example of ribis d'rabbanan, right? It's not going to be ribis d'rabbanan. Let's say a late fee for Con Ed. Let's say Mr. Con Ed is Jewish, so it'll be an isser of ribis to him, and or Chevrat Chashmal, better yet. So if you are paying extra because you didn't pay on time, that's called Schar Hamtanos Malos, but since it wasn't a loan, it was a business transaction because you bought the Chashmal, and now you're paying back with extra, that'll be ribis d'rabbanan, and a late fee would be an issur d'rabbanan. Let's talk about a different issur. That is sa b'sa. Sa b'sa is that even if I borrow a commodity, not a money, but a commodity, so Chazal say, even though I'm going to borrow a dozen apples and return a dozen apples or a dozen eggs, we are concerned that right now the apples are worth 10 cents each, so I owe you $1.20, and next week they'll be worth 13 cents each, so I'm giving back, when I return the dozen apples, $1.30, 10 cents more. So therefore, Chazal say, you should never borrow and return items, even if they're the same item. That's exactly what happens on the commodities exchange when you're sort of trading futures. You're saying, I'm giving you, I'll buy or sell or lend you certain commodities, and then you'll get them back later for a higher price, since you're dealing with, again, 100 pounds of this or whatever, 100,000 pounds of this or tons of this, and you'll give me back the 100,000 tons later, but it's at a different price. That's the whole point of the commodity exchange. That would be a problem of sa-ba-sa, even though, again, it's not katsutsa because you didn't plan, you didn't say there's a rate, there's a fee. You're just giving you 100,000 tons and getting back 100,000 tons, but at a different, they might be worth something different later, so Chazal said, avoid that. When you short a stock, the point is that you're borrowing the share and returning that same share. So if the shares go up in value, you're returning, well, you lost money, but you're also going to be giving ribis. That would be a problem. There are two atayim that the Gemara and the Shulchan Aruch paskin regarding sabasa. First is yeshlo. So if I have one egg and I need five eggs for my cake, since I have one egg, it's yeshlo, I could borrow a dozen eggs from you and return a dozen eggs from you. The second heter that the person give is Yotza Hashar. If there's a set market price that is sort of all around the city, we're not worried that, over the course of the next 2 weeks, I'm going to, if eggs are in this town, eggs are $1.99 a dozen. All over, it's a set price, set market price. So if I borrow a dozen eggs, we're not worried that next week it's going to be, $2.19. No, it's a set price. What price is out? Yotza Hashar, we're not worried that there's going to be price change. A third scenario where there's a heter for Sabasa is what usually happens in our apartment buildings. I need a cup of sugar, so I go downstairs to the glatz and say, I need a cup of sugar. So he's not giving, it's not a loan, it's not a halva, it's not a she'ela, it's not a halva. He's saying, he's just a nice neighbor, here's a gift. It's a matan mu'atas, just take it for you. I pay him back, I don't pay him back. If I do pay him back, a little bit more, a little bit less, no one's really makpid. That's another heter. An area where there's a problem that people might not think about in terms of prepayment discounts or late payment charges is theoretically that should be a problem with newspaper subscriptions, because you're paying a little bit up front and getting a lot a bit later. So if we assume that you're paying this little amount, the reason why they're giving you this gigantic subscription discount is because they need your cash for their cash flow for the year, so that you're giving cash up front, they'll be happy to give you extra stuff, like more editions of their magazine. That would be a problem. But halacha l'maaseh is not really a problem, because that's not why they're giving you a good deal. They're giving you a good deal because they want either to lock you in, or they want to have higher advertising populations. So l'maaseh, it's mutter to subscribe to a newspaper, if it's a mutter newspaper to read. In terms of dealing with banks, this is the next point. Now, the halacha is that I'm not allowed to charge or pay interest to or from a Jew, and so to a partnership of a Jew and a guy. If that's the case, so perhaps there are banks that have significant shareholders, Jewish shareholders, so how could I pay or take interest from my savings account, or how could I pay interest with my mortgage? So the first point that we have to discuss is the concept of a corporation in halacha, which is a legal fiction that basically makes any of the people in the business not personally liable, otherwise known as limited liability. And by virtue of the fact that it's limited liability, what that means is that there's no shibud haguf. If something happens with the company, I can't collect from Mr. So-and-so, I can only collect from Citibank as a bank, and not from any of the people in Citibank, even the shareholders, even the primary shareholders of Citibank, I can't collect from him, so that he doesn't have there's no shibud haguf that he has to pay me anything. So therefore, the Igros Moshe says, since there's no one there in Citibank that personally has a shibud haguf to pay the interest, I'm allowed to take interest from them, because it's Citibank giving me interest, not any individual, because the individuals themselves are exempt by virtue of the limited liability corporation. However, this is a one-way street, and that would not permit me to give interest, as in paying a mortgage, to a corporation based on this story that we just said. Let's talk about Heter Iska. Classical Heter Iska. You take out a mortgage, certainly from a Jew, you can write a Heter Iska. Bank of Ulmi, all the Israeli banks will have a Heter Iska for all the Jewish clients. How does it work? Let's use a $1,000 loan with assume a 10% interest rate. So I lend you $1,000. By 12 months from now, I want to have $1,100 back. So I'm not allowed to do that. So what I'm going to do is the following. I take the $1,000 and I split it in two. I have $500 that I give to you as a free loan. Free loan, there's no interest whatsoever, nothing to talk of. The other $500, I'm not going to lend to you. I'm going to keep it for myself, but I'll hand it to you. I own it, but I'm just handing it to you to please make me a silent partner. I'm going to join in your investment in your pizza store, and I'm assuming that I'll be able to profit from the profits that your pizza store realizes. So let's say, again, I'm aiming for a 10% return on my $1,000 of cash that I'm handing to you. So if $500, if half of that was an investment in, $500 was free loan without anything tied to it, and $500 was my investment, so if I want to make that $100 total profit on my investment, my $500 investment, what percentage am I asking on the $500? I'm asking for 20% return. So I'm saying that I'm going to invest $500 with you, and I'm going to assume that this pizza store is in a good location, it's on a good block, I think you should turn a 20% profit. Now, at the end of the year, two things could happen. You could say, sorry, buddy, the pizza store did not make as much as you thought, in which case I'll say, okay, so since it's an invest, the $500 you pay me it back anyway, because that was a loan without anything tied to it, pay me $500. In terms of the money that I invested with you as a silent partner, well, I would like you to please hire an accounting firm to ascertain exactly what my share of profits were with the $500 that I invested with you. and I'd like you to double check and hire another Big Four accounting firm to double check those findings. In addition, I'd like you to swear Nikitas Chayfetz and Basedin Shudaraisa exactly what the profits on my $500 that I invested with you, and whatever other things, and I want you to bring Adam, and I want you to show me every single receipt payable, both incoming receipt and outgoing receipt, to ascertain exactly how much you owe me, what my share of that $500 is. Or, if you want, we could just assume that my $500 investment turned a 20% return, and you could just give me $100 for, and we'll assume that was my return on my investment, and we'll call it even. I won't hold you responsible for any proving of how much the return actually was. So, what happened? $500 I lent you, and you gave back to me. The other $500 was an investment, and we assumed that the return on the investment was a 20% return, which is $100. So how much do I end up with? One $500. The other $500 investment plus the 20% return on that $500, which is $100. So I end up with $1,100, which is exactly where I started from if I would have lent you $1,000 at 10% interest rate. Any questions? Yeah. Because otherwise, what should I really be getting? If it's an investment, so how much should I be getting back? Only whatever my investment profited. Maybe it wasn't. Maybe it was only 2%. I don't want that. Maybe it was 3%. I don't want that. I'm going to end up at the end of the year with $1,003. I want $1,100. So therefore, I'm going to be mechayev of you. If you're going to say anything less than this amount that we both mutually agree on right now, you're going to have to prove. I have the right for you to have to prove it, because you have to prove to me that, I mean, you agree that you'll pay, you know, whatever that I invested in you. You could do that. You could bring, you know, find the accountants and do an shuvim nikidas chayves and give me exactly what you owe me, and it won't be 20%, and I might end up with a lower percentage rate. But if you want to avoid that, you'll just give me the percentage rate that we both mutually agree. Keep in mind, when you do this heteriska, you also want to make sure that, remember there was that first $500 that you lent him as a free loan, and now he's investing the other $500 for you in managing the pizza store, so you should compensate him for the work that he's doing. This way he's not, you don't say, oh, I lent him money, and then he also invested money, he also ran this pizza store that I'm a silent partner with as a payment for the loan, the first $500 loan, so therefore you should give him a $2, just free, a free $2 as a payment for the work that he's doing. Yeah.
Is heteriska something that's like commonly used among Jews, or is it just like something that's used like in Eretz Yisrael where, you know, where banks are basically just...
Anybody who's Shomer Halacha uses it. Yeah. Yes, it's very, 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 very commonly used. Now, there are some limitations to the heteriska. First of all, the whole yesod of the heteriska is that we don't really know how much profit was accumulated, and therefore we're relying on, he's going to have to prove it, and it's going to be hard to prove, so he could forego that, you know, proving what the profits were by just paying a set amount in return for not having to prove it. But let's say we all know what the profits were. For example, like a house. Everybody knows that market rates, that the housing market in this area is up 3.6%. So what do you mean you will just assume it's 20% unless proven otherwise? We all know it's 3.6%. What are you playing games with? So therefore, by mortgages, heteriskas will be a little bit problematic. Similarly, the whole point of the heteriska is that I am giving you, besides the loan, I'm giving you money to invest, and you're giving me a return on my investment. What happens if I'm giving you money that you're not really investing it in a pizza store, but you're taking that money and going to school with it? So how are you going to give me the return on that, on the money that I'm giving you? You didn't invest in something and there's a profit that you're sharing those profits with me. So here, Rav Aaron Levine, I don't know if he's the one who made it up, but Rav Aaron Levine, who's the professor of economics here and used to give this contemporary halacha shir on Ribbis years ago for his nifter, suggested the following, that whenever you have a loan, the loan has what's called an amortization table. What that means is that on the first year, let's say you take out a $1,000 loan. So you're going to pay back the same amount every month for the next 30 years. Now, let's say you pay $10 a month. The first month, you're paying $1 in principal and $9 in premium. A few months later, you're paying $2 in principal and $8 in premium. A few months later, somewhere a few years down the line, you're paying $5 in principal, $5 in premium. Towards the end of your loan, you're paying $9 in premium and only $1. I'm sorry, I didn't mean principal, I meant interest. Let's start again. The first year, the first month that you make your payment, you're paying $1 in principal and $9 in interest. As time goes, you're paying away more of the principal. The principal is going down. The principal is, you're covering, I'm sorry, the interest is going down. Your amount that you're paying for the principal is going up. By the end of the loan, you're paying almost everything, just paying back principal, and there's such a tiny loan left, the amount of interest is going down. So there's always a balance. It's always a $10 payment, but sometimes it's here. And then as the loan goes like this, they shift, but there's always a combination of between the premium, between the principal and the interest payment, it's always $10 a month. Now, that interest that you pay, in the beginning of the loan you're paying a lot of interest, by the end of the loan you're paying just a tiny amount of interest. So that means, let's say at the beginning of the loan when you're paying a lot of interest, that means you're living in a house and paying a lot of interest for that house. But whose house are you living in? If you've only paid 1/1,000th of the price of the house, who really owns the house? The bank owns the house. By the end, it's the opposite. By the end, you owe 999% of the whatever, 999 of the $1,000 house. So who you own most of the house? You have to pay the tiniest little. Who owns that 1/1,000th of the house? The bank. So you should pay them a tiny bit of rent at the end. At the beginning, you should be paying the bank a huge amount of rent for being able to live in the house that they really own. So said Rabbi Levine, if you just substitute on your mortgage, on your amortization table, the word, take out the word interest and write in the word rent, that will solve the whole problem. Because you could say that the amount that I'm giving you, let's say at the beginning of the loan, the $999 on the first payment of the loan of interest, and there's only $1 of principal, you, instead of calling it interest, say that's the, it's really the bank's house, you're paying $999 of rent, because they own the vast majority of the house. So by substituting the word rent for interest, that could change how we look at this whole deal, and you're paying rent, you're not paying interest. I know that was a little confusing. If you need more time, you could think about it some other time. One very important application. Let's say you have a cousin or a brother who's nice to you. You don't have good credit. You want to buy a car. So your older brother is nice and he says, take my credit card and go pay the down payment with my credit card. And then who's going to pay the interest? Well, you'll pay him the interest because, of course, it's for you. The problem is that who really was the loan to? When using the credit card is a loan. Mr. American Express is setting up a line of credit for your older brother. So that means American Express is lending money to your older brother. And who has to pay that money to American Express? It's your brother that's paying American Express. So how did the money come to you? Well, your brother also lent you money, and you're paying back the money to him to pay American Express. Or you're just paying American Express for your brother. That would be ribis, perhaps even to Araisa. You're borrowing money at an interest, of course, if there'll be interest. You're borrowing money with interest and paying a fellow Jew just because he's being nice and then he uses his credit card. That ends up not being so nice because he's charging you interest. What do you mean? He's just charging you whatever you would have to pay. Right, but since your brother's the one who has the card issued to, is borrowing from your brother and paying your brother interest. Yeah, what was the question? That is correct. That's why, unless you write it like this, it won't work. If the bank doesn't want to do it, then there's nothing to talk of. Correct. If you're dealing with the Hamish mortgage lending company, which there are plenty of, then you could ask them to write it in and see if they will or won't. But that was conceptually a good idea. I'm not saying that banks do that. Okay, next shir. This is just about the last shir, and then after this... Wait, we did Chol Moed, right? Yeah, we did Chol Moed. After this... We could talk for 2 minutes about preparing for Pesach, the Rebbe Brandes shir, in just a minute or two. So this is basically the last shiur for today. The laws of tzedakah and a little bit of ma'aser at the end. So first of all, there are two sources, two chiyuvim to help people. One is that there's mitzvah to do chesed from v'ahavta rechah kamocha, mitzvah to help people. And secondly, pasuk appears eight times in Devarim alone, v'halachta b'dracha. Why do you need two psukim to basically be mechayev the same things? Because there are two goals of doing chesed. One is to actually help somebody who needs help and get the result of that person having what he needs. Secondly, so we could be like Hashem. Now, one question that comes up is it better to give a big donation to one person or smaller gifts to many people? So while the Maharal and Yaakov Emden says you should make a bigger difference in one place, what's more famous is the Rambam and the Bach Pass, that it's better to give many gifts to small, you know, many smaller gifts. But of course, if you're going to give a penny to a million people, that's not going to help anybody. What's the reason for this giving out smaller gifts? So there are two possibilities. The Rambam says because every time you do a ma'aser, you become more of a generous person. The Bach says because by the fact that you're giving many gifts, you're touching more people. Nafkamina, what happens if you give many gifts to one person? So if the point is to become a giver kind of guy, then you are. You give many times. If the point is that you're touching many people, you're not. Also, if you're giving to an organization, if it's an organization that's distributing tzedakah, so the organization doesn't have to work on its midos. Maybe the Baalei HaMosad do, but the organization doesn't. Therefore, there's no point if the point is to become a better person. The organization doesn't have to, and therefore they should just focus on doing a better job, not becoming better people. There's a second halacha in the context of tzedakah. The Shulchan Aruch says you're not supposed to give all your tzedakah to one person. The question is, what does that mean? The Masham limits that. It just means that over your whole lifetime, you shouldn't give to just once. Like I have my tzedakah, I only give to the JNF. All I give to JNF from the day I'm born to the day I die, all I'm doing is planting trees in Israel. So that's not okay. But it's okay, according to my Hashem, that this year, this month, I'm giving only to the JNF. Next month, I'm only going to give to Yad Eliezer. The next month, I'm only going to give to Hatzalah, or whatever it is. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky says that it's a little bit of a difference. It's not the word that... I'm not sure exactly what he's saying, but he points out that if you're a gabbai tzedakah, and you're only going to give to one organization, so people might not give you... If you only give to JNF, and you're the gabbai tzedakah for the shul, so that means all of you guys who are into the JNF will give tzedakah, but the other people, since they know you're only giving one place, and it's not their cup of tea, then they're not going to end up giving you, so the whole tzedakah fund is going to go down. So therefore, you should distribute the places where you distribute the monies, so that more people will pile their money into the tzedakah fund. The Torah says that tzedakah has to be given de machzaro, enough to satisfy his needs. What are the needs? So there are three levels of need. Whatever physical needs are necessary, food, shelter, ability to get married. There are psychological needs, like having servants running in front of you wherever you walk. And third kind of needs, that even if it's not, you know, basic human needs that you need, and it's not psychological needs that you've convinced yourself that you need, but they're communal standards. Even if it's not what the person needs, and the person's not even accustomed to them, if that's a communal standard, I remember there was a boy here in the yeshiva that was getting engaged, and he didn't have money to buy the collar ring. Whatever the family situation was, and he didn't. And I remember speaking to one of the rabbanim here, and he said, okay, so we have to raise money to buy him his collar ring. I can think of a lot of ways to spend tzedakah money. There are people who are dying of hunger. There are people who don't have clothes to wear. Diamond rings might not be where... But no, that's his third halacha, that even if it's not for, you know, the physical needs, not your psychological needs, but that's just the communal standard, that does warrant tzedakah. Now, if we have taka halacha of de machzoro, so so-and-so needs de machzoro, which is $40,000, they knock on your door, does that mean that you have to write a $40,000 check? Well, the Rama says that this chiyuv of de machzoro is not a chiyuv on any individual person, baal tzedakah, but rather it's the chiyuv on the tzibur. others argue and say, no, it's achiv on the individual, but lamaisa, we do what we can. There are certain limitations to when day machzor does not apply. You don't have to give the person all that they need. First of all, if the person doesn't want staka, if they don't want staka, so there's not... if the person doesn't want staka, so then you don't have to give them certain amounts because they don't want that staka. Secondly, let's say a person has money but he doesn't want to spend it. So there's machlokas how you deal with such a person. One person says that you lend the money and you collect from his yarshim. Another person says, no, you don't give it all because he's not chaser. So there's no de machzor, there's no chaser because he doesn't want it. He doesn't want to spend, so there's nothing that's being chaser. A third situation where we do not apply de machzor is, let's say a person can work, but he chooses to make a living as a collector. So Rashi Dam says that there's no de machzor because he could go work himself. Others argue and say there is a mitzvah, but obviously, if you're dealing with a situation of limited funds, somebody who can work for themselves is going to be a little bit lower on the list than somebody who direly needs the money and has no other options. Now, there are Yisurim Daraisa to not give tzedakah, which is a little bit scary. That means if somebody asks me for money, every single person asks me for money, I'm not allowed to say no, I can't. It's an Yisurim Daraisa or multiple Yisurim Daraisa. So first of all, there are a number of ways out or limitations of the chiyuv and the yisurim d'oraisa of not giving tzedakah. The Rashba says it's only if the person is actually toveya. Also, it's only if, I don't know if there's mention of the shia, but I believe it's only if the person is collecting for themselves. If somebody is saying, I'm collecting for families in Eretz Yisrael, that by definition means you could say, I don't want to give you. If they're collecting for themselves, then you would be mechuyuv. It's actually, although the Rashba I just mentioned says that's only if they ask, if they're Tavei, the Rav says no, even if they don't ask, you still violate the Surim. Another limitation, again, of at least De Machzoro, I don't know if it's the limitation to the Aver of Nakim Stak or De Machzoro in general, is that the Chiyuv of De Machzoro only applies to somebody in your community. And it could be these Chiyuvim also, in terms of Stak in general. Somebody else, there's no chiv of taking care of their needs, it's just a chiv of a matanah mu'akah. So if somebody knocks on your door from the neighborhood and says, I have 16 children, I'm marrying three of them off in the next 2 weeks, so then, even though you could write a check for $30,000 for three chasanas over the next 2 weeks, and that would be de machzara, but since they're not in your community, you're only obligated to give a matanah mu'atas. Thirdly, the Gemara is mashma, that if you don't trust the person, you don't have to give the person, which is often the case. There are two people in the community, there are two people who collect outside of the street that I've often been asked about, and one of them is, you know, clearly not Jewish, although he puts on a good act, and there's no chiv. And he was smart enough to, you know, collect on Purim when he thinks people are going to give him, and everyone's going to give him. And people, you know, and sometimes even better not to give people if they use it for the wrong things, which is also the case with at least one or two people who collect over here. I'm not talking about the people who come to Beis Medrash. People sometimes on the street, they approach you on the street, ask for money, you have to just be aware or ask if that's who that is. Finally, it could be argued, I'm not sure if there's a source, what the source is, that the Isra of Al Tameses Levavcha, and W. Kofetz Yad is only if you're a person who hardens your heart, who doesn't give tzedakah in general. But if there just happens to be one time that you didn't give tzedakah, that might not mean that you are violating Los Ames Sevavcha, because you're not giving out of stinginess, you're just saying that I have limited resources, and I think there's somebody else or some organization that could use it more than whoever's knocking on my door right now. So it's not, I'm not being Ames Levavi, I have limited resources and I have priorities, and you who are knocking on my door is not my priority. Fine. So who are priorities? Let's go to the next point. We'll talk about them in a moment, but just to list them off, first is family, then there are tzaddikim, then a yircha, then a Eretz Yisrael. And let's talk about each one. In terms of family, the closest relative comes first. So if your parents need money, that's the first address of where you give tzedakah. Very impressed. I once went out with a girl. She was already getting older, and she had a good job. And her father was getting older. And her father knew how to learn. And she was talking about the ability to let her father retire, go into learning, and she'd support her father to sit and learn because she was already whatever. I didn't get married so young, so she was a little bit older with a really good job, and it was very impressive just to see the Avas HaTorah. But yeah, your father, parents are the first priority. Now, when we talk about giving to family, the way it works like this: so whenever we talk about priorities of kedimos in tzedakah, the kedimos work like this. Let's say the first level of people who are closest to you, like your family, and then your yerachan, and then your acheres, it's not that you give, it's not that they're the most important people, so you give everything to them. Let's say the first level is your family. So you're going to give 60%, 66% of your tzedakah allocations to your family. How much is left? 33%. Of that 33%, you will give two-thirds of it to Anye Ircha. How much is left? Whatever is left, you'll take two-thirds of that and give to Anye Eretz Yisrael, let's say. What's left of that? Take two-thirds of whatever is left and give it to Anye Yerushalayim. What am I up to? Anye Eretz Yisrael. Whatever is left, you'll take two-thirds of that and give it to whatever is left to who are not family, who are not Yerucha, who are not Eretz Yisrael. That's how the levels of Kedimos go. Now, as far as giving, next point, when we give tzedakah, it's lechatchila to give to people who are, if you have a choice of giving to people, give people who are tzaddikim. So Rav Kook apparently says nowadays we don't know who a tzaddik is, so forget that. But Rav Moshe says, when it comes to, it could be, it's not related to this point per se, but although private money should first go to family, public monies, communal monies should go to tzaddikim. First address for a communal tzedakah fund should be to tzaddikim and the like. When we talk about Aniyei Yircha, that they come first before other aniyim, we don't mean that if somebody in your city, his car broke down and he needs his car, that goes before somebody in Bnei Brak who's going to starve to death. What it means is that if all levels, all needs are equivalent, there's a person here whose car broke down and a person in Bnei Brak whose car broke down, it's more important to help the person here whose car broke down because he's Aniyei Yircha. However, if they are not incomparable needs, obviously the food of a faraway person will come before a car for Aniyei Yircha. Now, Rabbi Feldman mentioned a number of reasons why Aniyei Yircha come first. First of all, interesting svara, Ein Mavir Nal Mitzvos. Second of all, maybe you could, I have this in my notes, but I don't understand it, maybe you could help me. It will be more impactful because it's local. What does that mean? You'll tell me when you look at your notes, why isn't it more, it's here, so that means just, you're going to, maybe you don't have to pay like shipping costs and stuff like that. I don't really know. You give directly to where the person needs the most. I don't really, sorry? Oh, impacts me because I see it.
You're
improving your own community, maybe. I'm not sure what that means. Okay. But then the next point, which is the third point, is that in general, I'm not getting how he proves it, but your first concern should be at the people in your environment. Nothing to do with the second, but thirdly, that you have to be most concerned about people that you're close to. And fourth is based on Sanach, that is the Gemara, the Pasuk says you should help first with your enemy, take care of your enemy, Lakafes Yitzro. So by helping, you see that helping people, the more you help people, the better you get along with them. So by helping in Yerucha, you'll get along better with the people in your city. Okay, just those are just 4 points, what the Svara for Yerucha's Kedima is. As far as Aniyei Eretz Yisrael, fascinating limitation, Rav Osner says that as far as Aniyei Yerushalayim, the Chasam Sofer Torah Tumim says that Yerushalayim comes first, so there's a fascinating limitation that Yerushalayim, why should Yerushalayim have Kadima, because of its Kedusha. Well, which part of Yerushalayim has Kedusha? Only the Old City. So that would mean only tzedakah in the Old City would have a din of Aniyei Yerushalayim. In general, what's the svara that any Eretz Yisrael should have a Kedima? Well, either because you're also sort of fulfilling Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, or you could say in a different way, it's similar to Aniyei Yerushalayim, that we're all benefiting from people in Eretz Yisrael. It's mashpia on the whole world, and therefore we're all benefiting from that. As far as Meiser Ksafim is concerned, in general, when I asked Rabbi Feldman to speak on Meiser Ksafim, he said he didn't really want to because he doesn't really hold that there are any halachas to Meiser Ksafim. Because he said he's a big fan of the Nota B'Yehuda, which is how he started. Nota B'Yehuda says he doesn't like paskening because the Noma Kores and Shas for the Geder of Meiser Ksafim. But then he goes on, then the Nota B'Yehuda goes on and proves whatever halachi he wants to prove in Hilchos Meiser Ksafim. So he just starts off with that. So there are three sources for Meiser Ksafim. Tosa says it's a Chiyuv Daraisa. Pasuk says, Aser Taser Es. Wrong. Kol to us. Zaracha, the word kol is miyuter, to be marbe, not just tvua, but income as well. And therefore, if that's the case, it should be the halachas of Meiser Ksafim should be a function of Meiser, which needs a din chalos hafrasha, it's to aniyim, and whatever other limitations, it's similar, it's limud from Meiser would be. The Taz says no, it's only a chiv d'rabana. And the general consensus of poskim is that it's only a minhag. Inasmuch as it's only a minhag, the minhag will depend on how you are makabel this minhag on yourself, which, when you learn Meiser Ksafim B'Iyun, you'll see that there are a lot of nafkaminas of how you makabel it on yourself to only give to poorer people or even to give to things like zaka and hatzalah and gift of life and other such pseudo tzedakos. The halachas of tzedakah is not like Meiser. Every Jew has to give a third of a shekel for tzedakah a year, regardless of how much money they do or do not have. As opposed to Meiser, it only is chal on somebody who can actually afford it. Therefore, it could be that most of you guys who can't pay for your own expenses yet, soon you'll all be very wealthy, Be'ezus Hashem, but in as much as now you can't pay for your own expenses, your parents are helping you, your other people are helping you, you are probably not chayav to pay Meiser whatsoever. What Rosh Hashanah suggests, when I've spoken to him about these kinds of situations, that you could write down how much you know you've earned, and Be'ezus Hashem, when you become really rich, you'll be able to, in whatever shul or whatever Rebbe position you're going to Be'ezus Hashem have very soon, you'll be able to give the monies that Meiser on the monies that you've earned years ago. There are two. We're going to finish this year. There are two exceptions to when you are allowed to give. Normally, you're not allowed to give any more than chomish. Two exceptions. If you could give chomish and you'll still be wealthy, like Rosh Hashanah likes to say, like himself, he could give more than a chomish and still have lots and lots of money. Or, based on the pasuk, after a person dies, leaving over tzedakah so they could give more than a fifth, because you know, if they give a fifth, they'll still have enough to live because they're not living anymore anyway. So those are the two exceptions. Let's just finish off. Do you want to do the shiur for Rabbi Brandon for 2 minutes and run downstairs for Mincha? We could do this in 2 minutes, fine. So, just one or two points about preparations for Pesach. Let's talk about kinyos. This is machlokas. First of all, kinyos do not aser if they fall into a tavshil. What's the reason for kinyos? It's machlokas rishonim, whether they might have gotten either that the grains might have gotten mixed up with chametz, or separately, some Rishonim are concerned that they might get mixed up with, they used to make the kinyas into flour, people might come to use wheat flour. The Igros Moshe says that the gzera was only on whatever the gzera was on, whenever they made this gzera a few hundred years ago, 1,000 years ago, and therefore potatoes, even if we make potato flour, and even if nowadays we make potato cookies and potato pancakes and cakes and breads, it's not going to be subject to kinyos. As far as quinoa, apparently the OU doesn't give a hashgacha because Rebelski doesn't. The OU does this year. Okay, so this is my notes from last year. Fine, so now COC, Amstar K, and the OU all are allowed quinoa. So, but you have to be careful that it has a hashgacha because they sometimes has grains on the machines. Keep in mind when you're cleaning for chametz that any piece that is pachas mikazayis and that is metunef ktsas is not chayv in beer. And therefore, if you have some Cheerios underneath the that are dusty underneath the refrigerator or the oven, those are not chayav in bedikas chametz. And I will stop with that. So, Be'ezus Hashem, we'll have the second Chazar Shir on Tuesday at noon or 1 o'clock. Does anyone have Shir this Tuesday?